Okay, please be seated, please. Okay, we'll go ahead and call our first case, which is case number 63730, the State of Nevada versus District Court, Cody Wallace, real party in interest. We have Mr. Auer representing the petitioner, Mr. Quaid representing the real party in interest. Mr. Auer, you may proceed. Did you wish to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, today I want to discuss with you the policy arguments favoring disqualification of the trial court judge in the State versus Wallace. And I'm going to start by going backwards to your language in the Cripps case. In all future cases, any off-the-record discussions between the judge and the parties relating to a potential plea bargain shall be prohibited. Further, we will apply a bright-line rule prohibiting any judicial participation in the plea negotiation process. So first, it's our position that the trial court's secret non-reported meeting on June 18, 2013, where the judge advocated for settlement of the Wallace case, clearly violates the broad and expansive language that this court set forth in the Cripps case.
Second, but that same paragraph you're reading from in Cripps concludes by saying, if such a violation occurs, the defendant may withdraw the guilty plea. And that's the sanction, if you will, that follows the Cripps violation. What I didn't see linked up in Cripps, although your brief suggested it, is that a Cripps violation requires disqualification of the judge, which is different than withdrawal of the plea.
Yes,
the Cripps violation could destroy the voluntariness of
right,
the plea.
That's the fourth thing I'll talk about, but we'll jump to that, okay. And that is that we're requesting the sanction of disqualification. The difference between the Wallace case and the Cripps case is the violation on the plea negotiation comes to the court after a plea is done. In this case, we have an ongoing criminal case where you have a sitting judge still going forward, hearing other matters in this case, including a future motion on whether or not double jeopardy will attach after mistrial. And so the cases that we've cited to the court show that in these instances, disqualification is an appropriate remedy. And I would suggest to you, Justice Pickering, that disqualification is a very limited remedy given the violation that we have here.
We're not asking
to remove the judge. All right, go ahead.
What is the prejudice in this? Because depending on the facts of this, the purported statement by the court, possibly both sides were unhappy with the statements of the court, not just one side. So how is you're getting into a bias and a prejudice, but there's no showing of bias and prejudice as you're talking about future things. So can you enlighten me as to that issue?
I will try to, Mr. Justice Douglas. Actually, the prejudice inures to both sides, no matter what happens in this case. So later on, if the case got settled along the lines that the judge suggested of count two, the child abuse count, what happens later on when it comes back to you on post-conviction and the defendant says, oh, I didn't want to do that, I wanted to go to trial, but the judge forced me to take the plea on the child abuse count. Now you're using judicial resources later on in post-conviction because it's prejudiced the defendant. The cases that we've cited to you in our brief show that there are cases where the state is prejudiced. The
hypothetical that is not, it is a hypothetical because we have a case where the plea is not accepted. We had a trial that ended in mistrial. You're now asking for disqualification. How are you actually prejudiced? How does that bias you?
Our position, Mr. Justice Douglas, is what exactly was said by the Cox Supreme Court of Maine and Cox, which is it would be the perception of the public, and it's certainly my perception that trial court judge's future actions will be to carry out what the trial court judge said that the sentence should be in this case, which is 2 to 15 years. This defendant's already been incarcerated for 4 years. So it's going to be the appearance of fairness, the appearance of impartiality in any future motion practice before this trial court, as far as the state's concerned. The judge will be trying to carry out what the position was that the trial court judge advocated for in the secret meeting, which when the judge told me, this is not a first-degree murder case. You should offer the child abuse count. He should only do 2 to 15 years. So it's our position that all future actions by the trial court judge will be to carry out his advocated position. He's no longer a neutral arbiter of the law. He's an advocate for his position. That's our position.
So, Mr. Auer, your position is that under the Tobin test, when evaluating professional misconduct by the judge, the test is whether the conduct is sufficient to cause a reasonable person to question the judge's impartiality, and prejudice isn't part of that test.
That is correct, Mr. Justice Hardesty. And if you looked at the N. Ray U.S. case that we cited out of the Seventh Circuit, they said it would be almost impossible for a prosecutor like myself to prove actual prejudice. But if a reasonable person thinks that the impartiality and the fairness of the judge would be no longer there based upon the facts of what happened in the settlement, then disqualification is appropriate. And that's what happened in the N. Ray U.S. case, was the trial court judge was disqualified by the appellate court. So it's our position, we don't have to show actual prejudice. We just have to show whether or not I'm a reasonable man. If I'm not a reasonable man, then maybe we lose.
Well, at least the judge reviewing the motion for disqualification has to make the assessment as to whether a reasonable person would believe that the judge's behavior would create the a level of impartiality.
Well, and it's further our position, Mr. Justice Hardesty, that you now make that decision de novo. If you look at the N. Ray U.S. case that we cited, that federal appellate court took the case up on de novo review. This is an allegation of misconduct on the part of a judge and a lawyer. Under Supreme Court Rule 99, you have original jurisdiction over the conduct and the misconduct of all lawyers in Nevada, including this judge.
So what do you consider to be, there are some differences between the statements made in N. Ray U.S. and what Judge Rogers said here, but what would you consider to be those either acts or statements that this court would find constitute an appearance of impartiality by the trial judge to a reasonable person?
I'm going to address your question in two ways, Justice Hardesty. Number one, in the Cox case that we cited, that court didn't even go through an analysis of whether or not the statements had to be extrinsic, intrinsic, all that kind of stuff that the federal court went through in the N. Ray U.S. case. They just simply said, you violated the rule, their equivalent of the Cripps rule, it violates the judicial canons of ethics, and they concluded, therefore, that there was a sanction appropriate there. That was a post-conviction case. In the N. Ray U.S. case, that federal court judge did go through analysis under the reasonable person standard. And the case is very similar to our case in that there were matters that dealt with the prosecutor's decision to go forward that were questioned by the trial court judge in the N. Ray U.S. case and were questioned by Judge Rogers in this case. Hey, too much taxpayer money's been spent on this case. And by the way, I still have the mistrial motion hanging over your head. And this case needs to be settled. And too many judicial resources have been spent on this case. And in my opinion, this is not a first-degree murder case. And this is the second time that prosecutors in your office have had tapes where something went wrong in the tape, and I'm worried what the Supreme Court will think about that. Those are extrinsic matters, not just narrowed to the Wallace case. And so it's our position, whichever way you go, if you want to just enforce your bright-line rule, I mean, if you're going to have a bright-line rule, and you have a clear violation, then you need to have a sanction to enforce it. That's our position. The other point that I would make, and I kind of drived at it already a little bit, is this also implicates the doctrine of the separation of powers. When I originally was going to try this case in the summer of 2013, I met with the little dead two-year-old boy's mother and his father and one of the grandmothers. And we had a discussion about first-degree murder and the punishments, the child abuse count and the punishments. And we had a discussion about second-degree murder and whether or not I should offer that. And the rigors of trial and the fact I could lose the trial or I can win the trial. What do you want me to do? Because I want their input. And at that point, they wanted me to go forward to trial. That is the prosecutor's decision. It's not the judge's decision. So when he decides, hey, this case isn't a first-degree murder case, it shouldn't go to trial, he has usurped the prosecutor's function of deciding, does this case go to trial or does this case get settled? This case needs to be settled. That was not the trial judge's decision. That was the prosecutor's decision. So if you look in the Cox case, they say, when a judge offers a lenient sentence to a defendant charged with a criminal offense in exchange for a guilty plea, he usurps the function of the attorney for the state. It lies within the province of the executive branch of the state through the offices of its